Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. True crime stories have fascinated people for decades, whether they read them in print, periodicals, followed them in the newspaper, or on television, or in more recent times, subscribed to myriad podcasts devoted to the genre. It's clear these stories are popular and they are here to stay. But survivors of crimes and their families and friends can sometimes be exploited in the process of telling these stories, and questions surrounding the ethics of gathering them have become a needed topic of discussion for those conducting the interviews, writing them up, or producing them for radio or audio and video consumption. The National Center for Victims of Crime have already put together a guide of best practices for journalists covering these stories, and we'll delve into that this hour and talk about why true crime stories garner such intense interest. Renee Williams is the CEO of the National Center for Victims of Crime, and in the interest of full disclosure, her organization interviewed one of our producers, Sarah D'Elia, for the guide that I just mentioned. Sarah was one of numerous journalists interviewed to compile the best practices that should be happening around these stories. We're also joined by Dr. Charlie Tuggle. He is the Stemmler Distinguished Professor at the UNC Hussman School of Journalism and Media at UNC Chapel Hill. And Dr. Marissa Harrison is Professor of Psychology at Penn State Harrisburg and author of Just as Deadly, The Psychology of Female Serial Killers. Thank you all for being here. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Charlie, let me begin with you. As a professor of journalism and a former TV reporter, define this true crime genre. For those who may not be true crime aficionados, exactly what are we talking about here?
Sure. It's basically looking at crimes that have happened, often cold cases, but not always, and what led to the conviction of person X, what the police did wrong, what the prosecutors did wrong. A lot of it is going back in time and kind of recreating what happened in the investigation. And it really varies, Mike, between legitimate true crime podcasts and sort of off the wall true crime podcasts. I think it has a lot to do with, are you practicing capital J journalism? Are you just wildly speculating about what you think happened and what needs to happen to the perpetrator, to involving the family, to the police, to the prosecutor, et cetera, et cetera? So I really see it in two camps, legitimate and not as legitimate.
So there are many ways that content creators of this genre can approach this topic, but no matter how you do it, Americans, Marissa, seem to be fascinated with crime. It permeates almost everything on television, the nightly dramas, the police procedurals. Aside from periodicals and news magazines that ultimately morphed, aside from periodicals, one news magazine on television kind of morphed into a true crime series, and that's Dateline on NBC. And we are told by politicians, of course, around the country that crime is rampant. Violent crime is particularly rampant. That is not true. We know that to be a fact. It's not true. But the impression is that no one's safe anywhere. So with that impression, why are people drawn to these stories? Why do people want to read your book about serial killers who happen to be female?
I could tell you my take on it in that I believe we possess something called morbid curiosity as fueled by protective vigilance. So what does that mean? So first of all, I'm a research psychologist, so I can't help talking like this. These are the words I use. But protective vigilance, I think we are tuned deep down in our psyche to pay attention to the things that could harm us. Now, I'm not saying people think Ted Bundy could jump through the television screen and hurt us. I'm saying we are pre-programmed to pay attention to those things to keep ourselves informed to a certain extent. And we might feel an adrenaline rush. We might find it exciting in some way just to pay attention to harmful things. You know, when there's a unfortunate car accident, something like that, we can't help but look. I think that this is the same type of phenomenon.
You may not know the answer to this, Marissa, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Is this a worldwide phenomenon, or is this particularly American, this interest in true crime?
I could tell you from my perspective. So I'm not a true crime author per se. I'm an academic and I wrote an academic book, but I do get requests from all over the world, Netherlands, Germany, England, Wales, Scotland, Canada. People want to talk about this, Australia, New Zealand. So I don't know if it's a Western world type thing or a worldwide phenomenon, but I could tell you, I know that there's billions of people around the world that consume this type of media.
And it's certainly English speaking, because the PBS survives on these procedural detective stories out of the BBC. To get a full picture of any crime, you have to hear the victim's side of the story. And that, of course, is the job of reporters and the outlets that they work for to gather that, whether it's reporting on a garden variety neighborhood crime, if there is such a thing, to the heinous acts of a serial killer. You just can't report the things that happened. You have to talk to the family, to the friends, to the neighbors, to acquaintances of the victims or the survivors. Renee, up until you published your guide at the National Center for Victims of Crime, what were the standards for this kind of reporting?
Well, I think we had some excellent journalistic standards. I think the problem that we were looking at and what led us to publish this piece was that podcasters don't necessarily follow the same journalistic standards that we ask others to. And so for podcasters, and really for documentarians that we're seeing spin out and folks making TV shows, there were no standards. It was a little bit like the Wild Wild West.
Wow. And still is, I would think, to this day.
And still is.
A lot of times, the victims of crimes or their families will find themselves on camera doing interviews in the immediate aftermath of a tragedy. And one thing that your organization does, Renee, aside from helping journalists understand the ethics of this kind of reporting, is to help those being interviewed weigh the pros and cons of whether or not they should be interviewed. How do you do that? What do you tell them?
Well, we are actually releasing a companion guide to the Journalist Guide for victims to walk folks through those decisions in case we can't get to somebody. But some of the things we ask people to consider are you happy with the police action on the case? Are you happy with the prosecutor action? Because in some ways, that is where really engaging with the media can truly help. But one of the things we also remind them to consider is that you can't control the public and you can't control what the public thinks about you. So if you choose to engage with the media, you have to be prepared for some really horrible comments. And my advice to every victim who chooses to engage is don't read the comments section, which is not very pragmatic. It's very impractical. But we want folks to be prepared for everybody feels like they can have an opinion, especially when they're sitting behind a keyboard and a computer screen.
As you pointed out, Charlie, a lot of these true crime podcasts at least deal with cold cases, which are cases that have maybe taken place a long time ago that remain unsolved, or that perhaps there's some question about the decisions reached by prosecutors that may be wrong or right, or at least in the eye of the podcaster or the content creator. But as a former TV reporter, there's another kind of crime, and that's the one that's just happened. It's different when you're talking to a victim of crime 20 years after the fact. It's another thing to do it the night of. When crime occurs in an area, local TV reporters descend on the families of victims. And it strikes me as the worst assignment that you can get as a reporter, because you're invading the privacy of people who are in shock and who are grieving. Why the need, as a former TV reporter, why the need for those interviews at that time?
Well, of course, television is driven by ratings and by getting it first. We would hope that you want to be right in addition to being first. But, Mike, one thing that I've found throughout my career is that oftentimes the family members find it cathartic to talk about the person who just lost his or her life, even if it's a child. They find it cathartic depending on how you approach it. So we teach our students to be people first, be a human first, then be a reporter. Right? And if you're a human first, you can empathize with my gosh, this young mother just lost her husband or whatever the case might be. So I think it's all in the approach. If you just rush in and start asking questions, well, you're not feeling that person's pain. And you have to feel that person's pain in order to give him or her a voice. And often they want a voice to talk about, you know, their loved one. But it all comes down to the approach.
We're talking about true crime today and the reporting on it, both in podcast and in real world journalism on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. One of the comments I hear most often when people stick microphones in the face of grieving families, Charlie, is that, what do you expect them to say? It's not unlike these post game interviews with athletes, where, you know, if they drop the ball on the goal line and didn't score the touchdown, what do you expect them to say? I dropped the ball. What is the value for the viewer, for the listener, for the consumer of these interviews with victims and victims' families?
Sure. Well, again, you know, I think it goes back to something that Marissa said, that we have this innate interest in things that can harm us. And if things harm other people, then those same things are possible harms to us. So we're drawn to that kind of story. But again, if you use the term stick the mic in the face, if that's what you do, you're not practicing what I call capital J journalism. You're being more or less a voyeur. So you talk to the people ahead of time. I'm Joe Smith from XYZ TV. We're terribly sorry about your loss. Would you like to talk about person X and what kind of person he was and what he meant to the family? And again, it's just, you have to know how to deal with people, not as story subjects, but as human beings.
I'm going to ask you, and then I'm going to ask Renee about this. Is this being practiced? Is this practice widespread in the real world of journalism, in newspapers and television and radio, et cetera? Is that a widespread approach?
You mean to talk to the family members, or
to approach them properly? Is that a widespread practice?
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, I can't put numbers on it, but often, I won't even say often, occasionally, someone takes the wrong approach, and that kind of taints the entire industry, right?
But then,
so we as journalists need to be responsible, and we need to hold each other accountable. It's like, hey, Joe, wow, that was kind of rough. I don't know if I would have taken that approach.
But then we have podcasters who are working for themselves. Many of them are completely untrained, Renee. What about those folks? Maybe they're working on cold cases, but maybe they're also working on contemporary cases. I have about 45 seconds. Are you finding that they understand that approach?
No, they absolutely do not. And I will also say that, back to Marissa's point again, the general public, even when done incredibly correctly, doesn't always understand that approach and doesn't always understand that these are individuals in the worst time in their lives. So we have people picking apart their psychology while they're on TV saying, well, I wouldn't do that. Well, I wouldn't act like that. God, I wouldn't look like that. I wouldn't say that. And so it really takes a master interviewer to be able to help tell a story in the best possible way, knowing what they're facing with the public.
We're talking about the ethics of and interest in true crime reporting, and we'll get into some of the nitty-gritty of all of this as it has unfolded over the years when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com. www.charlottetalks.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about true crime, the interest that we all seem to have in it, and the ethics of reporting on it, how you do it. Renee Williams is with us. She's the CEO of the National Center for Victims of Crime. Dr. Charlie Tuggle is a professor of journalism at the UNC Hussman School of Journalism and Media at UNC Chapel Hill. And Dr. Marissa Harrison is a professor of psychology at Penn State Harrisburg. In the media guide, Renee, that the National Center for Victims of Crime has produced, you point out that with the plethora of true crime stories, victims and survivors and families can actually use what you call the unwanted glare of the media spotlight to their advantage. Talk about that. How do they do that?
Well, when we say the unwanted glare, we mean that often the public starts to view these individuals as characters, and so they get a little too intense. But you can use that media glare and kind of shift the spotlight, so to speak. So if you have police that aren't intensely looking at a case, use that. You can also use it to keep people's eyes out for individuals who are missing, because a lot of times our interest in these starts with missing persons cases. And so what is a better way than to find a missing person than to have everyone in the nation looking for them?
And despite the fact that sometimes as we watch these interviews on television, we think their reporters are being intrusive, as Charlie mentioned, some of these victims of crime and their families find the experience of talking about their loved ones who have experienced this. They find it cathartic. So Marissa, talk about that from a psychologist's point of view. Why is that cathartic? Is it any different really than talking to friends and family about what happened, as opposed to being on television or talking to a podcaster about it?
Well, I would think, like Charlie said, that it's just kind of a relief to get it off your chest. But I did want to address something, if it's okay, that Renee and Charlie were also talking about, in that I think people who write academically about crime and whatnot, like I do, have a responsibility in that, you know, I'm not going to take part in podcasts or any kind of broadcast that uses exploitation. So if anybody asks me to give an interview, if you have gore in your background or you're drinking alcohol while you're talking about victims, that's not something I'm going to take part in. I think that really hurts people. And I'd like to share a story, if I may. I have a colleague who her close family member was a murder victim, a high profile murder. If I said it, you would know who it is. I'm not going to say it. She was asked to be on some podcasts. She was on a prominent podcast. She didn't know what she was getting herself into. And after the interview, they had edited in music and said, "Oh, what a sexy murder." And this colleague of mine was devastated. And so, like Renee and Charlie said, I think we have to try to be really sensitive. And I know the public's very interested, and I don't want to be hypocritical. I wrote a book. I want people to read it. But at the same time, these are real people with real lives. People have been the victims of the most horrendous things possible, and their families and friends and their colleagues are co-victims, and we have to be really, really careful and really sensitive to how we present and consume this information.
But that's one of the problems here, particularly for victims and their families who are being sought after for these stories, whether they're contemporary stories or they're cold cases that podcasters are dredging up. Unless it's a local newspaper or a local television or radio station that you hear and understand what their agenda is, you don't know what the agenda of a podcast that you may have never heard of or listened to before. So Renee, how do you vet if you're a family of a victim and you're thinking about going on mic or on camera? How do you vet these organizations, these people?
Well, I think the most important thing to realize is that you can, and you are allowed to do that. And you're also allowed to do that with journalists. A lot of victims have not been told that they can do that. But then have a list of questions ready. Ask them what the angle is. Tell them, you can give them a list of questions that they are absolutely not allowed to ask. And although it's not fair to put the onus back on victims, do some research, listen to previous podcasts. A lot of these podcasters are going to show their true hands. They're not just suddenly going to start playing awful music in the background. They've been doing that for a long time. And so listen to one or two episodes and do reviews. And I will add that victims have a right, first of all, with journalism, to ask for a story to be redacted or to ask for corrections. And a lot of victims don't realize that. But if something really atrocious has happened on a podcast, victims can speak out about that too and draw attention to the fact that that podcaster is not always doing things incredibly ethically.
And once again, podcasters aren't all journalists and they're not all trained. But as for when it comes, Charlie, to trained journalists, she brings up some interesting things that people have rights. Let's talk about the parameters of that, whether you are sought after by a reporter or a news outlet and you say yes to the interview, or whether you seek that outlet out because you trust them and you have a story to tell and you're likely to get it on the air if it's about crime on television, at least. Do they have, do the people participating on the other side of that equation have a right to set parameters? And are news organizations bound to accept those parameters ethically if they do the interview?
Absolutely, you have the right. We can all verbalize the word no, right? We're all capable of saying no. And just as Renee was saying, I would not go on a podcast that I wasn't familiar with. Maybe I haven't ever heard of it, but I'm going to go listen to a couple of episodes and I'm going to know this one's legit. This one's not. I would do something with Delia D'Ambra at Counterclock, but I'm not going to do something with Joe Smith that, you know, XYZ podcast.
But I mean, that might work.
The approach he takes.
That might work if it's a cold case or it's been a case that's been languishing for 3, 4, 5, 6 years. But in the moment, the moments after, are you in a frame of mind to do this kind of vetting before you agreed to talk to somebody, Renee?
No. Oftentimes, no, but we also encourage all victims' family members to appoint a spokesperson to get talk points ready to go and to only work through one person. A lot of organizations, a lot of police departments and prosecutor's office will offer victim advocates. They can be incredibly invaluable, but even if they don't, we encourage families to find one person. Doesn't have to be an attorney, doesn't have to be a professional, can be a family spokesperson, and you go through them for everything.
And Marissa, these wouldn't be on television and radio and stories in the newspaper, et cetera, if there wasn't interest in this on the part of the consumer. And this gets back to this morbid curiosity. What is it we are getting out of it?
It's true. If I may, I just wanted to circle back to what Renee said in that in our worst times, we're not thinking cognitively. That's our brain's fear centers are the ones that are taking over. We might not know what we're saying, what our surroundings are, right? Your amygdala gets the first vote. Your fear centers do. So it is a good idea to appoint a spokesperson. You had asked what morbid curiosity is, and it's interest in what is morbid, something that is horrible, horrific, gory, etc. We tend to gravitate toward those things. And I think most people have just about maybe most people have average, I guess that goes without saying, but I think most people have just this interest. Okay, wow, what was that? And some people don't want to hear it at all. I have a friend who doesn't even want to see my book, a good friend of mine. She's like, I don't want to see, no, don't even, I don't want to look at it. And then there's people way down at the other extreme that go to crime conventions and they want to own t-shirts and hair that belong to serial murderers and knives and stuff. And look, to each their own, but all I ask is that maybe we have some sensitivity to the people that these horrible things were done to. If I might ask, one of the worst things I've ever seen, they sell resin statues of quote-unquote famous serial killers holding knives, holding ropes, Ed Gein holding a shovel where he might have been digging up remains of what have you. And I want you to think about who's on the other end of that shovel. That's a person. That's somebody's mom or their brother or their child. And I really hope people can try to remember that.
When these victims of crime and their families or the survivors of crime do come forward, they have a lot of reasons for coming forward or allowing themselves to be interviewed, whether they're seeking it out or they're being sought out. But there's a recurring mantra that we've heard from the people, Renee, who have come to your organization that they say about this. And it's, I never want anyone else to be hurt again the way I was hurt. Does participating in these activities with reporters and podcasters, does it give them some kind of closure?
I think to some extent, yes. I think that they think that they are also helping the investigation, getting information out. And I think that as both Marissa and Charlie said, there are some cathartic moments in that.
Marissa, most of these crimes that we think about are committed by men. And yet you have written a book called Just As Deadly about women who are serial killers. And although there are no hard and tried and true facts about the numbers here, because it's still out there, it's kind of nebulous, you think, if I'm right about this, it's about 1 in 6 of these serial killers are women. Is that correct?
Absolutely. So that's what authorities think, about 1 out of 6. But of course, we don't know about the ones we didn't catch. So, right, that's just an estimate. Yes.
And there are crimes that happen every day all over the country, and we see them on the news. And then there are heinous crimes that are reported on by having stories that are played out over a series of episodes in podcasts or on television series. And they have become extremely popular. The New York Times reports, however, that women are twice as likely as men to listen to and consume these podcasts, and that younger women with less formal education are particularly likely to listen. Some have estimated, according to the Times, that the audience of true crime shows is 80% female. You kind of furrowed your brow there, Marissa. I'm not sure you agree with those statistics, but
I've never read that. I want to know what study that came from. I remember one study, academic study, that claimed that women consume more true crime than men do, but the study was based on counting the reviews of the podcasts. No, that's the number of people who reviewed them, not the number of people who listened. So I, I'm a psychologist. I'm skeptical. I want to know where those numbers came from.
Well, according to that article, some of the people who watch and consume these stories do it because they believe that by consuming them, watching them, listening, they'll come to and understand the psychology of the criminals, which will help them to avoid them. Do you think there's any truth either in the theory or in the actual practice of that being true?
Absolutely. That's just another way of saying protective vigilance, right? So if I pay attention to the things that can hurt me, I could avoid the things that might hurt me. Absolutely.
How do you do this as a reporter, Charlie, without sensationalizing things, without blowing them out of proportion?
Well, I think it's balance. And again, I've mentioned sort of illegitimate podcasts that just total speculation versus podcasts that And I'm thinking specifically about true crime and cold cases that really delve into the facts and the evidence and the written reports and glaring errors that you would think anybody would notice. Why did they talk to this person and then completely switch who said these things and then completely switch to somebody else? What? How did that happen? So I think it's just a matter of balance. Present the facts without speculating on them, or if you do speculate, say that you are speculating, and then I can, as a listener, I can choose to listen to that speculation or ignore that speculation. But anybody can be a journalist these days. I just did air quotes, but not all are what I call capital J journalists.
Yeah.
And that involves really digging into the cold, boring facts sometimes, lengthy reports, poorly written, because police aren't trained to be journalists. They're not trained how to write necessarily in succinct ways. So digging into all that and really looking at why did they not talk to this person? Why did they not look at this document, which I was easily able to find?
We're talking about true crime today and the plethora of true crime stories out there in various forms of media on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Renee, your organization, the National Center for Victims of Crime, was created, as I understand it, in the aftermath of the Klaus von Bülow murder of his socialite wife, Sunny. This is a story about his failed attempted murder of his wife, which left her in a temporary coma, and then his alleged insulin overdose that he gave her, which left her in a permanent vegetative state for the rest of her life. He was convicted, and then those convictions were overturned or reversed. And Town and Country magazine called him the original true crime star. And thinking back on it, I think that might be correct. Why did those crimes and the coverage of those crimes lead to the formation of your organization?
Well, I want to correct one thing. I think that calling him the original true crime star is giving him way too much credit and way too much star power. We could go back to Jack the Ripper. Well, this is not a new phenomenon that we're facing. It's just our ability to consume it has become completely out of control. But yes, Klaus received quite a bit of media attention, as did Sunny. And you have to understand who Sunny was to understand that. She was stunning. She was a socialite, and she was wildly wealthy and led a colorful life. Klaus was her second husband. And so her children found that in the aftermath of her being put into a coma, their access to the justice system was because they were wealthy and they were still treated abhorrently. And so they wanted to make sure the victims, and they recognized that they had privilege and that they were coming from a place of privilege given their wealth. And so they founded our center to start working on a lot of the legislative work that we saw came out of the 1980s, such as the Victims of Crime Act, the Violence Against Women Act, and a lot of the crime victims' bills of rights that have been passed across the nation.
We've talked in this conversation about not forgetting that the people who are victims of crime and their families, their survivors, are people. They're not just statistics that are to be reported on in a story or a podcast. And you have created this guide at the National Center for Victims of Crime for ethical true crime reporting. And you also have 8 rules for true crime consumers. And the first one, maybe the most important one, is that there is no such thing as a victimless true crime. That seems evident on the surface of it, but I guess we forget about that. But you see it as something we actually need to understand. Is that because we do forget about it?
I do, and I think we start to think of them as characters. I will say the creation of the 8 simple rules came from, we do go to a conference called CrimeCon every year, and it's a lot of the folks Marissa was talking about. But we found, and this goes back to our Wild West moment, we found that they, when a mirror was held up to them, and not a funhouse mirror, a true mirror, they want to help victims at the end, and they want to do the best they can. But if you don't give people rules, you can't be mad at them for not following them.
I want to come back and talk about victims of crime as characters and how we shouldn't see them that way, but that is often how we do see them when we come back with Renee Williams, Dr. Charlie Tuggle, and Dr. Marissa Harrison. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Renee Williams joins us. She's the CEO of the National Center for Victims of Crime. Dr. Charlie Tuggle, professor of journalism at the UNC Hussman School of Journalism and Media in Chapel Hill. And Dr. Marissa Harrison, professor of psychology at Penn State Harrisburg and the author of Just as Deadly, which is a book about female serial killers. This National Center for Victims of Crime have published these 8 rules for crime consumers, one of which is that the most important thing is to remember that there's no such thing as a victimless true crime. Marissa, talk about the fact that when we listen to these or consume these true crime stories, we are experiencing the tragedies of real people. Is that top of mind? Does it even matter to the consumers of these stories, or do they just want to be entertained?
I can't speak to the minds of people who listen. I mean, everybody's going to have their own motivation for doing so. It might be to understand the psychology. It might be to understand the plight. Some people might just get some kind of sensation-seeking excitement out of listening to horrible events. But I did want to add something, if that's okay. I wanted to circle back just a little bit in that, as much as we're talking about how some people approach true crime irresponsibly, I've seen a lot of programs and movies done extremely well. I've talked to some networks and some local stations and whatnot that have really gotten victims involved, try to report the facts, no sensationalism, just really trying to tell the story. So there are some people who do it well. But I also want to say, and I've been doing this for a long time, there are some people, again, that don't do it well. I had a major network, and I won't say who, a major network call and ask me about a woman who committed murders. Well, she's a serial killer. I never heard of her. Oh, you never heard of her? No, I've never heard of her. So I'm Googling her as they're telling me, and she didn't meet the criteria for serial murder, which is three or more deceased victims with a cooling off period in between. They said, oh, they think she killed that third person. They think she did. Yeah, so can you come on and talk about her as a serial killer? No. Why not? Because she's not. So I'm not doing that to the victim, even the perpetrator. I'm not going to lie for you just so you can put a story together. So again, people who are interviewed for these things, they have to be careful as well and do some vetting as well.
And this is coming from a network. I'm assuming it's a well-known television network.
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Charlie, you're the professor of journalism here. How prevalent would that be at the network level? Because we expect those people to be highly trained and have higher ethical standards than anybody.
Well, you would expect that, yes. But let's take a look at people's trust in legacy media. It's cratering and has been since the 70s. And that's because we have people, even at the highest levels, who are not doing it the right way. And Mike, I wanted to circle back and touch on something you mentioned. You know, there is no victimless crime. Of course, there's the victim, there's the family, but way too often it's the person who is accused and convicted and jailed and sometimes executed wrongly. So since in the past 50 years, there have been 200 people exonerated off of death row. So somebody presented evidence that made a jury believe that this person did it when they didn't. So I think part of it is not just the victim, but the perpetrator. Is that the right person?
Yeah.
We have to, you know, if there's some question as to whether that person did it, it's very important, I think, for journalists and media organizations to dig into. And that's what some of these well-done true crime podcasts do, is delve into, do they have the right person?
Marissa.
I wanted to respond, Charlie. You have a wonderful point. And sometimes they get it wrong. But I do want to say many times, the police, FBI, CIA, they get it right. Okay. So it's, you know, I know that there's the case of somebody who's been exonerated. I know we need to work on that a little bit, but I want to give the police some credit. And I don't think journalists, and I don't think people on the internet, and I don't think podcasters could solve a crime as best or better than a detective can. So I agree with you on that, Charlie. Let the police do their job. Sometimes they can't reveal some of the facts that they're holding on to, but I have faith in the justice system.
Renee, in an unusual pivot, Ryan Murphy, who's the producer on television responsible for Glee, of all things, has pivoted. He's now producing riveting TV series about crimes. He focused first, I think, on the assassination of Gianni Versace. He explored the murders committed by Jeffrey Dahmer. That really garnered renewed interest in those heinous crimes. And he followed it up by telling the story of the Menendez brothers, who violently murdered their parents and were sentenced to life in prison, which got considerable viewership on streaming. But it also caused the criminal justice system to take another look at this case. And although it's been delayed, it appears as though the DA in LA might ask for a reversal of their conviction, or at least an end to their life sentence. This appears to have been the result of sentiment bubbling up from the surface because of this TV show, which was partially fictionalized. Do producers and writers of those types of shows bear any responsibility to not color the facts? And do you think that program did color the facts if you saw it?
trying to come up with a PC radio appropriate response for what I think of Ryan Murphy. It's not high, I will tell you that. That show colored the facts. He also did The People versus O.J. Simpson, where he made up entire conversations that never happened between Kim Goldman and her father. And I know that because I know Kim. And so Ryan Murphy is about money. He is nobody's hero. I want to be very clear about that. However, with the Menendez case, some good has come of it. And that was, we saw them as victims, which they were. They were victims of sexual abuse. Absolutely. And a lot of the facts were kept out of the first trial for different political reasons, and what was going on with the prosecutor at that time and what had frankly just happened with the OJ case. So I think that that trial did need to be looked at. I think some good did come out of that show. But I want to be very clear that it's not because Ryan Murphy took a paintbrush and decided to add red where something was white. It was because we needed to look at that as it was.
So Marissa, because of the incredible interest in these stories and the viewership of those shows that I mentioned that Ryan Murphy has produced, there's obviously great interest in this. But as we expose ourselves, whether it's in print or podcasts or television or whatever it may be, to these constant stream of stories about death and loss and sadness, are we putting our own mental health at risk?
Not sure about that. I do think we are prone to desensitization. So if I hear it over and over and over again, I'm going to pay less attention to it. It's going to affect me less so. And I think we need to be careful of that. Then again, sometimes it could sensitize you. I mean, I've been writing about this for 10 years, and I read stories like, for example, I'm writing a new book. I was writing about the Susan Smith case where she had drowned her sons. I had to put the stuff away and take the day off. It's horrible, even 30 years later.
Yeah.
And if I may, I just wanted to touch on...
I should say that the Susan Smith case is local to us here in Charlotte because it happened
is it?
In Rock Hill.
Okay.
Yeah, it happened in Rock Hill,
that's true.
Which is about 30 minutes from here.
She murdered her babies. It's true. I do want to say this. Again, we're never going to excuse crimes such as Susan Smith's and such as the Menendez. But the reverse we need to look at as well. And maybe what they didn't do in the Menendez case is look at mitigating factors. I mean, these people, I'm going to say it, almost always have had something really horrible happen to them. Now, that's not going to excuse murder or crime or brutalization of anybody else, but that tells you we need more psychologists and resources out there for people.
Is the increased interest in this, the increased availability of these stories, the increased consumption of these stories, the potential for traumatizing the consumer of these stories, is that perhaps leading to this impression that we are unsafe in America, that crime is rampant because it's everywhere on television, it's everywhere on the podcast universe, and it's painting an inaccurate picture of the real situation?
Oh, absolutely. I think Charlie could speak to this as well as a media professional.
Okay.
We tend to think what we see on TV is representative of, you know, the proportion of events out there. So if I see crime, crime, crime on TV, if I'm tuned into a crime channel all the time, then I'm going to be primed to look for crime. I'm going to think it's more prevalent than it is.
And it is on local news. If it bleeds, it leads. And local news has flashing blue lights everywhere you look. But what about that? Is our feeling of being unsafe in America being exacerbated by the media in fictionalized versions of these stories, Charlie, as well as the news?
Well, again, you know, buyer beware. You know, part of it's up to the consumer, that if you feel like what you're watching, what you're listening to, what you're reading is not representative of the way things are, then turn off the television or go to a different channel, go to somebody you trust. For example, personally, I trust the BBC over any of the national networks here in the USA. So I'm going to go to the BBC and see what they're saying before I form a judgment about, you know, what's happening out there in the world.
Very, very
but I
quickly.
Do want to come back to the point about the police, Marissa. I trust the police, generally speaking, but they're human as well, right? Yeah. They make mistakes. Prosecutors make mistakes. Sometimes they settle on something and decide that's the answer. and don't look anywhere else.
Very
so
quickly.
What I'm saying with that is, you know, let's look at the whole thing.
Very quickly, because we're really short on time here. Words matter, and we're living in a universe suddenly where people are throwing around words that are inaccurate, or they don't understand the power that they have with the words they use. And I've noticed that when you watch certain stories, like, for instance, on YouTube, they will change the words because YouTube will not let you say certain things, so they change the words. For instance, somebody has unalived themselves. I'm wondering about the impact of that. I mean, really, they're doing this because they told they can't say the S word on YouTube because it might lead to more S's. But is unaliving any different? And in terms of journalism, is it doing us a favor or a disfavor, Charlie?
Well, I hate the idea of word police. You know, who gets to decide which words are okay and which words aren't? That's supposed to be, you know, the ideas that are correct will eventually win the day. Don't tell me which words to use and which words not to use.
We're talking about true crime here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's something that's a plethora of stuff out there, and that's why we're looking into it today on Charlotte Talks. We've talked a little bit about cold cases, and what surprised me when I read through some of your material, Renee, is that you think it's better for journalists and podcasters and others involved in true crime reporting to focus on cold cases or closed cases. Why?
I don't remember us writing that, if I'm being transparent. I think that there is still a lot of value in looking at cold cases. But I will say one of the things we say is there is no timeline to trauma. And maybe that's what you saw. And that means that you have to treat somebody who was a victim 40 years ago with the same delicacy of somebody who is coming out now. We were contacted by a woman whose mother was murdered in the 1980s, and a very high profile network that does all true crime had posted a photo of her mother in a commercial dead. She had never seen that photo of her mother. So she saw her mother's body image on a TV show, and it was just as impactful to her. And so I think our focus was more, if you are going to do cold cases, it is just as important to treat them with the same delicacy as you would any other victim.
Well, along the same lines, in January, Annie Nicole, a writer whose sister was murdered 30 years ago, wrote a guest essay in the New York Times in which she said that true crime producers repackage pain as entertainment. Is that always the case, or only when it's not properly handled?
I don't think it's always the case. I have seen a lot of true crime producers, and we've been ripping on podcasts all day, but there are quite a few podcasts that are run by victims and victim families that are doing outstanding jobs, and they are doing it. You know, are people listening because it's entertaining? Yes, but they are doing it. And Sarah Turney comes to mind, who runs the Voices for Justice podcast, and Bill Thomas comes to mind, who does Mind Over Murder. And they are out there trying to make sure that the spotlight is where it should be and the glare is appropriate.
Of course, this is all about podcasters having more people listen because they get more money when that happens, and YouTubers do too. But then so does newspapers. Newspapers have snappy headlines for a reason. There are promos on television for newscasts that are there for a reason to grab your attention, to make you watch, because it's all about ratings. It's all about revenue. What role do ratings and revenue play in regular news operations when it comes to these crime stories, Charlie? And only have a 30 seconds.
Sure. No ratings, no job, no paycheck. Right. So I'm not anti-ratings, but I am very concerned about what we are sometimes willing to do to garner ratings.
And that is perhaps why you trust the BBC, because there are no commercials, no need for ratings, and perhaps why NPR is so successful. No commercials, no need for ratings. Renee, you have 8 rules for being a true crime consumer. Number one, as we've said, is remember that there are no victimless crimes. Quickly run through the others in 30 seconds or less.
There is no timeline for trauma. investigate. Don't listen to a podcast because they're drinking wine in their car. First of all, they shouldn't be doing that, but they should also know something. Always require the presence of victims' voices. If the victims didn't participate, they didn't want that podcast out there. Do no harm. Respect boundaries. Don't fall victim to true crime and turn your interest into impact. If you are interested in these things, support the victims because folks are making money off the back of them.
Renee Williams is the CEO of the National Center for Victims of Crime. You can go to their website and see those 8 rules. Dr. Charlie Tuggle, professor of journalism at the UNC Hussman School of Journalism and Media at UNC Chapel Hill, and Dr. Marissa Harrison, professor of psychology at Penn State Harrisburg and the author of Just As Deadly, The Psychology of Female Serial Killers. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.